Bow, babadoo-dow, 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 babadoo-dow. Open up your heart, jiggle, little, little, open.
Jiggle, little, open. That's where you are. That's where we are.
And we hope that's where you'll be for the next 70 minutes.
We're so glad that you've joined us for episode 19 of Jiggle Little Open. The thread that we tugged on from our last episode was falling into things. And as fate would have it, or what have you, perhaps not fate, but happenstance, we fell into our third guest ever. Last episode, we had our second guest ever, and suddenly we had a volunteer guest.
For the first time ever.
For the first time ever.
A member of our listening public.
A member of our listening public, who's also a member of Aaron's family.
Blood relations. It's true. It turns out to be someone I'm related to, but he's someone who called up, contacted, and said, I want to be on your podcast. Well, that's never happened before.
That's true. He is also the grandson of our first guest. So there's some Nepo baby stuff going on here, but, enlightening Nepo baby stuff. The guest is Jesse Schumann, Aaron's first cousin once removed on his maternal side, but on, removed to the following generation. He is Aaron's younger cousin. And we get a pretty recognizable and fascinating, I think, enjoyable glimpse of a particular moment of young adulthood that I think we've all, maybe not all of us, but both of us, Aaron Kahn and Ira Murfin, certainly have experienced and can remember when, the world is suddenly starting to get a lot bigger and more pathways are suddenly opening up, and there's a feeling that you've lived a lot more lives than maybe you actually have yet, and you can kind of sense all of this possibility coming, and it's coming so fast that you are trying to kind of capture it and record it, perhaps in the form of a novel.
A novel, a rap song, a podcast. Yeah.
So Jesse is full of recent experiences and stories, and also full of new cultural production, including his debut rap single, Post-Nasal, and we'll link to his various social medias and whatnot in the episode description.
I think I have to correct you there that Post-Nasal is his rap name.
Oh, Post-Nasal is his rap name.
Yes.
Oh, yeah.
What's
the song called?
I believe there's one song possibly called Post-Nasal, and I'm just looking quickly because I've watched these already, but I didn't take that note. Gestum as Bache Flow. That's something on TikTok.
I wonder if that's the video by the Argentinian barber.
Post-Nasal Gestum as Bache Flow, 5 days ago posted. So there's stuff coming out by this young man, and
there's definitely a song called Post-Nasal because he was quoting it to us, but it may also be his rap name.
That's my comprehension, is that it's like both. My name is
Jesse's had a lot of interesting recent experiences that he'll share with us. Most recently, he's returned from spending a few weeks in Argentina, and just to be clear, his perceptions, his understandings of those experiences are his own, and his own way of making sense of this. We can't necessarily verify or vouch for his particular understandings, but I think you know, they give a glimpse of how he made sense of being in Argentina. You know, he certainly talks about, you know, sort of the on the ground experience of Argentina as both a great place, but also a place that he experienced as, you know, having a lot of problems. And certainly Argentina has, you know, a complicated political and economic history, which, you know, I'm only glancingly familiar with, if that. So I will not claim to understand it, but certainly on the economic side, you know, inflation has been a big part of Argentina's story. So it's not implausible, as Jesse mentions, that he might have hired a professional music studio for $20 to record his song, and that may well have been the going rate. But, you know, without, you know, saying anything about...
Yeah, we're not a documentary of what happened.
Yeah,
we're not,
right. But also just to say that, like, the fact that he did that, you know, paid the rate that was asked in the place that he was is of, you know, casts no aspersions on him. But it is certainly also possible that, you know, that kind of economic situation, you know, creates opportunities for, you know, unequal exploitation by people from other economies, such as the U.S. In Argentina. So that is in no way a judgmental statement, just to say the world that he's describing in Argentina is a complicated one that we don't really delve into, but I just want to acknowledge that and acknowledge the fact that we speak about it, you know, glancingly without really acknowledging all of the complexities of it.
I want to say it reminds me a little bit of my sort of slow motion comprehension of, at least at the time I was trying to rent a car in India, not really possible unless you also rent a driver.
Huh.
And because of my cultural experiences and expectations as an American who's rented cars all over the world, I thought, you know, I'm getting scammed. And I actually made kind of a scene around it and eventually wound up with a driver and a car, but I was not comfortable with the arrangement, even though the price wasn't higher. The whole thing was strange for me. And I sort of had a remembrance of that when I listened to sort of the sort of appreciation and wonder and confusion at being able to hire the kind of recording studio that you normally wouldn't even visit, because they're, it sounds like, you know, big pop tracks in the past have probably been recorded there, national hits, like Big Place, and to just be able to do that for a $20 bill, when you're experiencing international travel for the first time and young, yeah, it spins your head around, and you know, it takes a long time to know if those are going to be ways that that become which path do you go with the knowledge of the intricacies of your American dollar.
It is, you know, to becoming a global citizen, as Jesse talks about, is a complicated process and a long one, and one that takes a lot of consciousness and thought as it's happening. In a very minor way, so, it reminds me of being in Mexico and discovering that doing your own laundry was not an option. It was like, where's the laundromat? There is no such thing.
Yeah.
But when you get your laundry done there, they fold it so tightly that it just comes in like a very thin plastic container. I was always just stunned by what happened to my laundry when I got it back.
Do they vacuum seal it into like a Ziploc or something?
I don't know if it was vacuum sealed, but it was like I couldn't They'd believe the volume of laundry they could so fit into tiny. A very thin, plastic container.
So I'm glad you started off by saying this is a, you know, a snapshot in a particular moment, because, you know, it's a really... I can even say, I think I maybe do say this in the episode, but I remember when Jesse first contacted me and said, I want to be on your podcast, I thought, cool, have you ever called me before? Like, I've known him all his life, but have we had any direct contact when we're not face-to-face? And so it's really, for me, kind of almost a discovery of my cousin, you know, at the age of differentiation and articulation and testing all the waters of opinion and joke and sexuality and travel and all the things that a mobile privileged 20-year-old might have a chance to explore. And it's for me, this episode is kind of awkward for me because he wants to make it public, but it feels for me private.
Yeah.
Just because I'm getting to know my cousin.
Well, there, I feel like there is a suggestion in this, in, between the lines in this episode that you may play a certain role in your family or for certain members of your family where you might go long times without talking to them. And then when they're ready for a certain kind of consciousness or experience or perspective. They're like, oh, Aaron, that's who you reach out to. Speaking of which, we do spend a little time talking about psychedelic mushrooms, and we touch on some of the advocates and thinkers who are associated with that particular realm of experience, namely Terence McKenna and his brother Dennis McKenna, the journalist and food writer Michael Pollan, who's recently written about psychedelic experience quite a bit, and the mushroom expert advocate Paul Stamets, whose mushroom advocacy straddles culinary and psychedelic mushrooms and even poisonous ones, and I think he's just a big mushroom guy in general.
Mister, I'm in service to the agaricon.
and then we have a very nice compendium of pop songs titled for other famous people than the pop singer singing the song, including Remy Wolf's Anthony Kiedis, Ice Spice's Princess Diana, a song recorded with Nicki Minaj, and SZA's Drew Barrymore, which I do want to clarify. I'm always confused about. I feel like I've talked about that song and video a number of different times, not on this podcast, but just in my life, and I'm always like foggy on it for some reason. So I mean, I won't try to recharacterize how I characterize the song because it's good enough, probably. Go listen to it. But she is sitting at the top of some concrete stairs, probably in New York in the video. I was like, she at the top of a hill, the top of the subway stairs. I couldn't remember when Drew Barrymore makes her little cameo in the video.
Dear listener, don't let that ruin this wonderful episode for you.
But interestingly, there's another song called Drew Barrymore by a different artist named Bryce Vine, and I think it's interesting. The song's pretty good, and in the video there's some like really great dancing, but it's an interesting glimpse into sort of the male gaze and like what an actress, probably any actress, doesn't matter that it's Drew Barrymore, might mean to a female identified singer and performer versus a male identified singer and performer, because in SZA's case, Drew Barrymore seems to represent sort of an emotional state or a personality in some way that she identifies with, and in the Bryce Vine song, it's very clearly about like Drew Barrymore as like a sexual, like, again, it's Drew Barrymore is kind of a oblique reference. The song's not actually about her, but like the reference is around sexuality and like desirability and like how desirable somebody is or not. So I just think it's an interesting contrast. We don't mention Taylor Swift's Tim McGraw in this breakdown. I'm sure there's others that we've missed out on as well. This might be the last episode of our season, although
time will tell.
Time will tell. We might decide. We're Aaron and I are both in a little transitional moment, so we'll take a little pause. We'll see what happens. Maybe there'll be one more episode in our season. And what is a podcast season anyway? We're not really sure. Going forward in our next season, I imagine we'll evolve a little bit. There'll be another shift, and probably there'll be more guests, I feel like, is the direction that we're going. But we don't know exactly what that will look like and how that will work. So
those giving our podcast a close listening might notice an increase in the frequency of guests appearing as we went from just one in the whole first season to two in the second. We might have 10 in the third. We've been thinking about it. It's a crazy idea. Crazy.
It is. It's crazy. It could happen, though. But
allora.
But thanks for listening, and thanks to Jesse for joining us. And enjoy this glimpse into his life and into Aaron's family and into mushrooms, pop music, Argentina, and Canadian meditation retreats.
Yeah. Yeah. And let me say the Nepo babiness, if someone who's not related to either of us somehow gets in touch with us and says, I really want to be on your podcast, the chances of you being a guest on our show, I think, are pretty good, even without any DNA, in common. So please don't get the impression that that we're going to keep this ratio of 2 out of 3 guests are related to me.
It's possible, although I feel like him getting on the show had, for me, a lot to do with it, that it happened to be the thread of falling into things, and it seemed so perfect. Yes. So,
yes, and was definitely connected to our first interview with his grandfather. So, yeah.
But yes, please reach out if you want to talk to us. Almost certainly, we want to talk to you.
All right, then. Let's listen to some Jesse Schumann post-nasal on Jig a Little, Little, Little Open.
Enjoy. All right.
Hello.
Hello. Welcome. Welcome to Jig a Little, Little, Little Open.
Jig a Little, Little, Little Open. A podcast that Ira Murfin can once again pronounce.
I know. I feel very, very agile in my ability to say it. We have a surprise for ourselves and for you, probably more for ourselves than for you. I remember hearing an interview once with somebody from the performance group Elevated Repair Service, who signature piece is Gats, this piece where they did the entire text of The Great Gatsby, and I think the next show they did after that was a show where they did an entire chapter of a Faulkner novel. And and before that they had done all sorts of other things. They were kind of more of a dance theater company. And, the artistic director or whoever it was said, like, we kind of decided that the most surprising thing that we could do next after Gats was repeat ourselves and do like something very similar. So this was not a strategy, but last episode we were lucky to talk to our second ever guest, Melissa Lorraine. And one of the things that I picked up from that conversation was this idea that I'm very awkwardly calling falling into things. not at all to question her experience and her narrative, right? Like, I was very interested that, at several points in our conversation, she talked about like not meaning to start a theater company, but she just started a theater company, or not meaning to move her theater company to Lawndale, but it just happened, it just happened. These things kind of just happening in some way. And, and I'm sure that reflects some, genuine reality, but I think it also like reflects a story that a lot of us tell ourselves of like life happens to us. Right. And there's a way that it helps obscure the kind of strategies and choices and things that happen for us. So I was thinking about this, and then at this idea of falling into things, happenstance, and then at 2 a.m. last night, Chicago time, 9 a.m. a totally decent time for Aaron in Paris. I got a text from Aaron saying, "We have a possible guest for our show." The podcast this week. And
I think what I said is something like, you know, for the first time ever, we have a guest reaching out to us instead of us reaching out to a guest.
Yeah, so
not only is today's guest our third ever guest in almost 20 episodes, but the first guest who, you know, we never even anticipated that could ever happen.
Right.
It never crossed our minds that someone might say, "Can I be a guest and speak with you on your podcast?" So
and I'd already been thinking that our theme would, or our thread that we would pull would be falling into things, and we seem to have fallen into a guest. So it couldn't be more perfect. So welcome, mystery guest, who we've gone almost 4 minutes into the podcast without identifying. Perhaps Aaron, you would like to introduce our
Jesse Schumann
guest. Sorry, I stepped on his name.
Jesse Schumann is a Chicagoan who hails from Oklahoma and with whom I share quite a lot of DNA. He is it correct? My second cousin, is that what Americans call our relationship? My first cousin once removed?
First cousin once removed.
He is my first cousin once removed.
He would be the second cousin of your child if you had a child.
Oh, that's very confusing. And I had recently a visit from your mother here in Paris and your sister. I'm generally fairly close with my cousin side of my family. So while it was funny when Jesse, you texted me last night and I didn't even have your number in my address book. So I said, you know, who is this? And from Oklahoma, which Oklahoman? And then I thought, wow, this is fantastic. So thanks to the magic of podcasts and, internet and all the other things that allow us to have connections through tech we might find much more challenging without. Please introduce yourself if you wish to take some time to do so.
You got it.
You know, there won't be a visual aspect to this in most cases.
Do you have an identity beyond being related to Aaron?
I like to think so.
I've always thought so. Ever since I first heard about you before you were born, I thought that soul has an identity outside of its relationship to me.
That's beautiful. Beautiful. I kind of fell into the world in some ways. I guess we all did. So, you know, Aaron sent me the promo of the last episode because he told me about this idea of like the through line. To be honest, I only listened to part of one episode of this show yesterday for the first time.
That's more than other guests.
And so I listened to, I scrolled to a random, like 40 minutes in, and I was partly listening, partly brushing my teeth, and she said, "Restoration of global citizenship." And so I'm coming back from, I spent 3 weeks in Argentina with my sister who's studying abroad there. It was quite magical. I want to live there when I finish college. It's magical in many ways, kind of a utopia, but also a dystopia. Like you go to a park and you play ping pong with a bunch of people and they all want to be your friend and there's dogs off leash running around and it's beautiful. But then you walk down the street and there's a dead body. But anyway, so, and you know, you're in Paris. Now Ira and I are both in Chicago.
Were you in Buenos Aires or somewhere else?
Buenos Aires. Yeah. And I went to Uruguay for a day. You just take a ferry across the river. It's a beautiful place. So yeah, I guess now I like to think of myself as a global citizen. I guess that could be part of my identity beyond Aaron Kahn. And honestly, so when I saw the name of the podcast and the picture, I was like, oh, this is beautiful. Like Aaron has this cute friendship. But then I listen to the podcast and you say, jiggle little open. And I'm like, oh, now I get it. It's very fun to say. I didn't realize that part. But yeah, and also, I like that you said falling into things, because I left school like a month and a half ago. I was really depressed, and I've decided I'm writing a novel about my grandpa, because I've like recorded 6 hours of conversations about his life and feel like I kind of know everything about him now. And I'm falling into a lot of things right now. And I think before I really wasn't, I think I was forcing my way into things. I wasn't jiggling, you know, I was taking my shoulder to the door, and that wasn't really working out. So just jiggling, just, you know, falling into things. So that's who I am right now.
Were you in college? The school you
left?
Yeah,
I was in Williams College. It was my sophomore year.
Gotcha. And the grandpa that you're writing about is the one who is also related to Aaron, or the other one?
Yes. Yeah, it was the one who was on our
first ever guest.
Our first ever guest. Uncle Joel, also known as Grandpa Joel.
Can I do a bit on my novel?
Sure, please.
Of course.
So
it's required. Everyone who goes on the show does a bit on their novel.
Of course. So I, you know, I came up with this 2 days ago. So, you know, work in progress. I already have a lot of notes. I'm going to transcribe my interviews. I'm a big Philip Roth guy. I'm a Jew. You know, I have a lot of self-hatred. And so my vision for it, you know, and again, 2 days ago, but it's about me leaving school. That's the journey. It's about me, obviously. But, you know, I suddenly have this really beautiful relationship with my grandfather, and I think our lives kind of echo each other's in a lot of ways. So my vision is, so I left school. My mom sent me to this meditation retreat in Canada because she's into stuff like that. And of course, it was all middle-aged women who signs up for a week-long meditation retreat.
What kind of meditation was it?
It's mindful self-compassion. I really needed some self-compassion. Yeah. And it was beautiful. Like, all these strangers, all these beautiful middle-aged women just gave me all this unconditional love. And I was able to, for the first time, tell people what happened at school. Mm. And before I really told my parents the full story, I was telling these middle-aged women. And my cousin Ezra came with me, who I had this really close relationship with. So that's act one is, you know, I'm there, I'm in Canada, I'm writing about my mom being crazy, but, you know, loving, and I'm writing about Ezra. And then I go to Chicago for Passover, which, you know, I can do a whole, that could be a book in itself, but, you know, Judaism and my grandma, and I got a tattoo for her. Right now the working title is Chad Gadya, I'm the one little goat. Which I think is pretty clever, and I can do a whole, that's the foreword, the preface is, you know, the history of that folk song, because it's pretty, the Wikipedia page, I highly recommend. Fascinating.
Interesting.
History there. And then I went to Buenos Aires, and it changed my life. I was with my sister, which was great. But then I found out I was bisexual on Tinder. I fell in love. And I still talk to I got married, not really, but like I got down on one knee and I gave her my pinky ring, and we were engaged until I left 2 days later. And also,
wow, you've really lived a lot of lives in a month really and a half have. Or however long it's been.
I really have. And like I learned how to speak Spanish while I was there. Like I took it in school, but never learned it. Like, oh, you know, could ace the vocab quizzes, could conjugate any verb, but like never wanted to speak it. Was embarrassed about trying to roll my R's, but now I can speak Spanish. And here's the bigger thing, honestly, is I'm a rapper now. I made, if you can see, I have a fresh cut. You know, it looked better, but he gave me this eyebrow notch. And
listeners, we can testify he has a fresh cut.
The cut is fresh.
I'm about to shave it all off, actually.
Me too.
And bleach it. Oh, really?
I do a total, not a shave like to the skin, but I do a kind of buzz of my head and beard once a year, usually around the beginning of summer. And so I've been doing that for like 6 or 7 years, maybe, you know, so like I let it grow all year. It's long and Bushy, and then
I think a lot longer than the 6 or 7 years.
The annual thing started in, I think it was 2015, so 8 years maybe.
So all right, 8 years? All
right, yeah. So I'm a
but yeah, yeah. And so what I do is an aspiring rapper. This is my barber, and he's like, I want you to star in my first music video. It's going to be a love story. It's a great song, by the way. That comes out next week. My song, Post Nasal. The joke is post nasal drip. I got there. There's smoke in the air. I was sick. But the joke is, as I explained to Aaron, drip. Are you familiar with drip, Ira? Concept.
I mean, probably not. I would think of either drip in the traditional sense or like calling somebody a drip, like a third generation of the drip.
There's like, you know, a rap colloquialism, drip kind of means like style. Like if you're dripped out, you're like dressed in designer clothes, you got chains on. So like that's
dripping
the
with diamonds. Drip. Yeah.
So the line is came through with the drip post nasal. And then we paid these professional producers $20, which is like 8,000 pesos. And, you know, I go into the studio for 2 hours and this beautiful studio with these like cute dogs, and they treat me like a musician. They're like, I'm like, I want to do that part again. I want to do some ad libs here. And it was great. And then the next day we went back, shot a music video. It's on all streaming platforms and YouTube now. Check it out.
This is post nasal your song, or this is the barber song?
This is my song. This is my song. So the barber song, so that music video comes out next week. It's my, you know, first serious creative endeavor. It's just incredible. I mean, going back to the Argentinian utopia dystopia thing, like you pay these guys $20 and these professional pay these cameramen $20 and they bring in their professional camera and the video looks great. So like everything's dirt cheap, but at the same time, the economy is, can I swear?
Yes,
I think so.
The economy is fucked. And like, because there's this insane history. There's this movie that almost won the Oscar this year on the Argentina 1985 about the trial of this, I want to say his name's Videla, this guy, there's a military coup and he took over, and then it was like a smaller Holocaust. He disappeared 30,000 dissidents. And if you're a perceived dissident, and he didn't send you to the gas chamber. He didn't just send you to the gas chamber. He disappeared. Your family woke up one morning, you were gone. Some people don't know what happened and will never know. So the movie's about the trial, this historic trial. They set up a new government because the military court wouldn't try them because they're all military guys. So they set up this government just to hold these guys accountable. And the country really never recovered. But it's a beautiful place and I want to live there.
The thing that Melissa said that you mentioned a while ago about, reawakening? What was the global story? Restoring global citizenship.
Restoration
of global.
I tweeted it. Check out my Twitter. I'm very active these days.
So I think first of all we have to put all of your handles and links in the description when the episode gets posted. So that'll be easier for listeners to watch your music video, etc. Listen to the barber song. I wanted to ask if like this period of time that you spent out of the country, was it the longest time you've been outside the States? The first time, like a month's, multiple months block in one place?
So I come from a very privileged background. Every year we would take some fabulous trip. We would do a biking trip in Italy. We'd go to Mallorca. We would, you know, spring break was always a lot of fun. This one time, my mom, when we lived in Chicago, she was a doctor at the University of Chicago. And they did this exchange with this hospital in Wuhan, China, of all places, which now we all know, of course.
Right.
This was before Wuhan was in the
news. This was a long time ago. How old were you?
I was maybe seven or eight. So twice I went to China. I left school and for 2 weeks went to China for 2 weeks with my mom. I was worshipped because I was a boy and I was cute. my sister didn't get that attention. Mm. You know, we all know that story.
I attest that she's also cute. You're both very cute.
She's very cute. I'm also cute. Yeah, I attest as well.
But your mom was there for like a long period of months, and you were there twice for a couple of weeks.
No. So she went three times. First time she brought just Noah. Then we all went with my dad. And then it was just me. So she went three times. We were there the whole time. It was just for 2 weeks, like once.
Okay. But just now you were seduced 3 months in Buenos Aires.
I think 3 weeks, right?
3 weeks, 3 weeks.
Oh, okay. I'm sorry.
Yeah, let's all right. Check that.
Ah, okay. So
left school a month and a half ago, right?
Precisely.
So all of this happened in a month and a half. It's sort of blowing my mind. The meditation retreat, the Buenos Aires, Passover.
It's a novel, right? It's a novel.
It certainly is a novel, whether it's a novel or not.
There you go.
Yeah, it is. It's a lot in a short period of time. I bet the location of the retreat was really beautiful. And as you say, it's middle-aged.
Nanaimo, Vancouver.
Oh, wow. I've been there.
On a lake. It was perfect. And wait, can I tell a sappy story about it?
Oh, it's, yeah, please.
So my sister's best friend in college, this is a little personal and she might be upset that I'm saying, I don't really care, but her friend at Bowdoin, one of her best friends ever.
Maybe we can just say best friend and at least protect anonymity.
Sure, let's do that.
We'll bleep the name.
Perfect. And she, you know, lacrosse player, whatever. Her brother was like in the junior hockey leagues. I don't know if you know about the hockey circuit, but like it's a grind. And you, like, I have this guy who I lived next to freshman year who's 23. He was a freshman. And because you play in the juniors until you can get a scholarship, and you're never going to play in the NHL, but it's your dream. So you do it. So
somebody's got to play in the NHL.
Yeah, yeah. So her brother, anonymous best friend, played in Nanaimo for a year, so she had that connection. But also, her dad died when she was young. And she sent this text to Noah when Noah told her I was in Nanaimo. And she's like, I know my dad's watching over him there. And I don't think I'm going to cry right now, but yeah, it was just very beautiful.
Everybody has license to cry after a meditation retreat in a beautiful place.
There were tears, for sure. There were tears.
They can come back anytime. All you have to do is picture that sunset.
You can't get that many hugs from beautiful Canadian middle-aged women and not cry.
I agree. I think there's not a person alive who would disagree.
Aaron, that's near your... There was a period where that was your stomping grounds, where you kind of pretended you lived in Canada for a little while.
It's on the tip of Vancouver Island, right?
Yeah, you just take a boat over from Vancouver,
So I lived twice for a few months each time in Victoria, BC, and taught yoga in Victoria, and did go to Nanaimo for a yoga workshop with Christina Sell once, and did a lot of, you know, hiking and mushroom eating around the Vancouver
Can
Island.
Can we talk about mushrooms?
We're equipped. The two of us are, and if you wish to, it's a subject we don't veer away from.
Okay, so I did mushrooms in high school with my friend. I won't say his
Me
name.
Me too.
And it changed my life. I believe in God now.
Wow. Okay, that is so succinct.
That sort of sums it up. I did mushrooms. It changed my life. Me too. God Me now. Too.
Quite literally. I'm thinking kind of a la your haircut. First of all, I might start doing the buzz once a year thing. But maybe right after the buzz, mushroom trip once a year. I think it's
you know, if you do, you'll spend a lot of the mushroom trip running your hand along the new buzz cut. That'll probably be the main feature.
Great mushroom hair. I've got some great mushroom hair.
You'll be like, I cannot believe the kind of sensations that I'm having in these just tiny hairs on the top of my head.
Oh yeah.
I was just showing last night a friend here the Terence McKenna book, The Archaic Revival, that I was reading in 1995 in Israel. We were talking about his theory that mushrooms are potentially either the missing link or part of the missing link between apes and humans, in terms of potentially dictating some of their migratory patterns and the development of language and the phenomes that make up language pattern. Potentially would have been easier to manipulate the vocal cords in complex ways when the ears were more sensitive to listen more carefully as well.
Let me just say, the listener can't see this, but my eyes are wide open and I'm nodding a lot. This is great.
Have you heard of Terrence McKenna before?
No, but I'm writing it down.
I'll show you the three books I have of his on my shelf.
Yeah, this idea that Aaron's talking about, it's definitely in the Archaic Revival, but perhaps a little bit more accessible in his book, Food of the Gods, which I think might be right behind Archaic Revival. Is that? Yeah. So that in that book, he kind of like, he says that book's like kind of like a Trojan horse, because he kind of writes it as like a more of like a plausible kind of anthropological book. But he's making this argument that mushrooms are the key to catalyzing language, especially in human evolution.
Is this viewed as like conspiratorial, or like do scientists buy it?
He has fans in the world of, you know, crackpot theorists and
sure.
conspiratorial thinking. And I think that his ideas about the role of mushrooms in the evolution of language are not widely accepted in sort of standard world. And then he has other ideas and theories that are definitely even farther out there. But he's also not totally off. He was an ethnobotanist. He was a trained ethnobotanist, and he has in the category of things that are sort of actually knowable in and provable in academic ways, I think he does have, some legs to stand on, but he's also very willing to, conjecture about things revealed to him by, mushroom and other mushroom psychedelic hunches. Intelligences. And, he's there in another one of his books, which is kind of the story of his discovery of mushrooms and, the psychedelic experience. He talks about
true hallucinations.
True hallucinations, yeah. He talks about discovering the object at the end of history, and how he he went around for years like drawing this picture that like came to him on a mushroom trip, and he would like show it to people and like expect them to sort of like, sink down,
have a recognition
to the floor, and be like, "Oh my catharsis. God!" And they'd be like, "What is that?" And he would be like, "It's the object at the end of history." And
what was it?
It's not this. This
no,
is a,
that's
a shamanist.
That's like an illustration of a something with mushroom hands, and part of his anthropological evidence for the role of mushrooms in human development. But then he talks about how he sort of developed over many, many years like a kind of explanatory set of theories, and a kind of logical case to carry his discovery of the object at the end of history, so that people could encounter this thing that he saw sort of in an immediate way and understand it, or approach understanding it in some way. So he's very good at sort of like straddling the kind of
the
logic that exists outside of human reason that you come in contact with in a psychedelic experience, and then kind of like packaging it or connecting it to more like sort of scientifically based
analysis
or presentation. And he actually has a brother named Dennis who's much more of like Terrence was kind of like, he's passed away unfortunately now, but he was much more of the kind of showman, both shaman and showman. He was like a great talker, and would kind of do you know, he was on like the lecture circuit, and sometimes he would like sort of perform with like, there's this great album called Alien Dreamtime that's like him at a rave with this like electronic psychedelic band behind him, and he's just like doing these like, you know, I mean, he actually called them raps, but not in the sense of rapping, but in the older 60s sense of like just like talking extemporaneously. So like he like there's like a kind of entertainment or a, like, you know, more cultural element of what he did. But his brother Dennis, who is still around, is like much more of like a serious scientific researcher, and has done a lot of work on not only mushrooms, but I think also DMT and ayahuasca and all these sorts of things. And some of his work is also about like ways that I think ayahuasca in particular can interrupt alcoholism and other addiction patterns. And, you know, he's a little bit more of the not the, you know, not the showman, but the kind of scientific researcher. So they kind of had a tandem relationship around that kind of stuff.
I just want you to know I've been taking notes, and there's just like a lot of the words you use I'm going to steal for a song about mushrooms. Can I just read some of this?
Sure. Let's process it.
Trained ethnobotanists, psychedelic intelligences, true hallucinations, mushrooms for hands, anthropological evidence. It goes on. It's great. Thank you.
But I guess I should show you this bronze little mushroom man Ira smelted for me in Arizona.
Well, I didn't do it, actually. I have one over here too, but I'll let Aaron show it because mine's pretty much identical.
This is made of bronze, and Ira made it and gave it to me, and it is a little mushroom shaman guy.
Where
do I get one?
I think it's a drawing that or like a cave painting or something that's in Food of the Gods. Like it's one of the images in there, and to be clear, I didn't make it. I commissioned it from our friend Nick Bortle, who just visited, or maybe even is just currently visiting AaronCon.
He's in Amsterdam now. He just ate mushrooms yesterday in Amsterdam,
and he was the bronze foundry manager at Arcosanti at the time, where we were lucky to. I lived, and Aaron had lived, and we had a bronze foundry because that was one of the ways the project was funded. But you could also get your friend, if they were the manager of the bronze foundry, to pour you
make you some
little mushroom man as a commission on the side. So there are only two in existence, as far as I know.
It's a very limited series.
For now.
You might be bringing that beat back.
It would look good. Speaking of like rap, it would look good on a big chain.
Around your neck,
I'm wondering, because this is a non-visual medium, the object is a small bronze figure that's basically a person whose hands are joined over their head. I don't know why I'm doing it.
Forming again, it's a mushroom to form cap right. The umbrella shape of
a
mushroom.
So it's a person and a mushroom. Yeah. I mean, think of YMCA by the Village People. If one of the things, if it was like YMCA and then mushroom.
Mushroom. Yeah. YMCA, mushroom. Right.
Exactly.
That's what he's doing. YMCA, mushroom. I feel like something that kind of, I don't want to say it bothers me in life, but it's something I sort of run into a lot is, for example, the three of us are talking about a psychedelic experience in a very quotidian, in a very sort of passing sort of manner, like, oh, yes, it's wonderful. Yes, I now believe in God. And I often struggle to get even the ability to have conversation with people who are either inexperienced or uninterested to be taken seriously, or to have this opportunity to find a way to express something about the mystical experience or the power of it or the things that it does. I haven't watched them all, but I'm glad there's all these Netflix documentaries about mushrooms and just psychedelic ones.
That Michael Pollan book, right?
Michael Pollan and Paul Stamets and the current sort of living, let's say, most well-known and prolific content and research makers in the field. There's even now the Multidisciplinary Association for Psychedelic Studies, which has existed for a very long time, is getting, you know, properly institutionalized and funded and sponsoring and accompanying a lot of very high-level research, long-term and well-received sort of legitimate research. But there's even in Colorado psychedelic retreats happening where, like, you can book an overnight camping trip with, you know, tent accommodations and yoga and mushrooms in the mountains during 3 days.
Here's when you know something's mainstream. Here's when you know something's mainstream is when your mom comes up to you and says, "I want to do mushrooms." That's when you know.
Did that happen to you?
Oh boy, did it. Oh boy, did it. She says a lot. She's like, "I'm going to get tattoos. I'm going to do mushrooms. When I die, I want to be in the desert and be in a tent and let my body disintegrate." She reads a lot, clearly.
I think when she was here in Paris, she said that she would like for me to provide mushrooms for her or something if she's to do them, you know, in Europe or something, just because.
Yeah, so, yeah, I believe that.
It's funny that, like, I seem to have somehow this reputation whereas no one ever really speaks in the family, no one really speaks to me ever in any kind of positive way about any of this until, like, there's never this sense that people understand or it's okay or there's any curiosity or admiration until suddenly there's this sort of very matter-of-fact statement out of the blue after, you know, decades of, like, yes, I trust you and your experience with that, and therefore...
When they, only when they want something. Only when they want it.
You're, I've had this sort of desire. Sort of like a figure of, you know, some kind of like, you know, a little imp or something, like tending the psychedelic fire off in the corner, you know, in a cave. And then, you know, every once in a while, somebody will sort of awaken to your presence and be like, oh, I must find.
Once every 20 years.
I must find that little man in Paris who's squatting over the fire of enlightenment and visit him and see if he will give me an ember from his pile of burning coals.
Some people are rich and some people leave rich lives. It's the fire of the burning coal. this is a reference, I think, to something Ira once said to me. And I do think that there's this funny gaze in the family back and forth in that way. It was in response to an analysis of a message, and it wasn't maybe in the show, so I'm being silly. It's maybe an inside joke.
Well, you know, you guys are related, and maybe your family dynamics are... You know, it's up to you if that's fair game. But it does remind me of I think of a moment from this essay by David Rakoff, the late essayist David Rakoff, who wrote this great essay about going to what's it called? What's that famous like New Age retreat center in upstate New York? Oasis, is that what it's called?
Omega.
Sure. Yeah, maybe Omega Institute. he goes to the Omega Institute for like a week of like it's a I think it's a meditation retreat and like Dharma talks by Steven Seagal.
Oh, no.
You know, because Steven Seagal's a Tibetan Buddhist.
Ira, has anyone said you look like Steven Seagal?
Nobody has ever said that to me. No.
I'm sorry.
but in, you know, it's the name of the essay is including one called Hell, and it's sort of, you know, this very dry and humorous essay about like the Omega Institute in general and sort of like the sort of New Age performance of like the New Age retreat. This would be great research for your novel. And but then also like the specific like shit show of this Steven Seagal workshop where Steven Seagal sort of like doesn't show up for hours and hours and they're like trying to figure out how to like fill the time and
yeah, he's like so late that it sort of ruins all the programming.
Yeah, and there's this moment, and David Rakoff sort of gets attached to this middle-aged, new-agey woman, like the ones that you were on the meditation retreat with. And he, you know, like, he's like, it's like, you know, it's first day of college, whoever you happen to have lunch with, you know, then they end up being your friend, whether you like it or not. And he sort of is trying to distance himself from her, but she's always like, you know, implicating him in her presence. And there's this moment where everybody at the workshop revolts against Steven Seagal and sort of, you know, is like, why, you know, you're not showing up, you're not giving us what you'd promised. And she's trying to be the peacemaker. And one of the ways that David Rakoff keeps making fun of her in the essay is like that she, everything's upspeak. She's like always asking a question, and she stands up and she's like, this reminds me of the chocolate cake that they serve in the cafeteria here. They serve it in very small slices because it's very rich. What we get here is very rich.
I'm reminded, I don't have some fancy essay to cite, but I do. So there's this my favorite singer. Her name's Remy Wolf. You should check her out. She's very talented. I saw her in Brooklyn in October. It was the best and only concert I've ever been to.
The only concert you've ever been to?
Yeah, we can talk about that later, but whatever, it was incredible. And she's just, you know, like genreless, just like incredible voice, but like elements of hip hop and R&B and pop and just everything. And she has this song called Anthony Kiedis. And so to go back to like the family stuff, she has a song, you know who Anthony Kiedis is?
We do.
Of the Red Hot Chili Peppers.
So she has this song called Anthony Kiedis. It's my favorite song. And the refrain is, I love my family intrinsically like Anthony Kiedis. And I was like, first of all, who's Anthony Kiedis? Second of all, what? And so I Wikipedia him. I could do a whole hour on Wikipedia. I wrote this essay and in speech and debate in high school, I went around the country giving a speech about the wonders of Wikipedia and why it's the solution to all our problems. But because I'll just say Wikipedia, you know, they have that thing where it's like, give us money, we need it. They don't need your money because people all around the world do it for free. And it's incredible. And sometimes it's inaccurate, but where do you go when you got a question? You got a Wikipedia. Anywho, so Anthony Kiedis had like a really tough relationship with his dad. Like he was abused or something. But I guess he wrote a book and he talks about how he still, you know, loves his father. And so I just think it's beautiful. I mean, it's like so wordy and funny to be in this pop song, but I love my family intrinsically like Anthony Kiedis.
I love my family intrinsically like Anthony Kiedis too.
Don't we all?
I think it's so interesting when pop songs or when songwriters like use another famous person as like a reference point in their writing.
Yeah.
Like I think, I don't know, that's who's the singer. I don't know if she's a rapper too, but I forget who it is, but she has a song called Drew Barrymore. Do you know that song? It's just like,
I don't.
It's like,
oh, Ice Spice. Are we talking about Ice Spice? No.
I'll look it up and footnote.
Shout
it
out Ice Spice
in the intro. Ice Shout Spice. Out Ice Spice. Is that one of the?
Do you know Ice Spice?
Is that a rejected? SZA, rejected. SZA. Yes. Yeah. Yeah. Exactly. Is that a rejected Spice
That's
Girl?
That's embarrassing. You might have to edit it out that I didn't know a SZA song. That's really not good for my rep.
But her song Drew Barrymore is like, it's sort of a song just about like, I don't know. I feel like I've tried to characterize it before and I don't always remember. I think I get it wrong. And then I go back and I'm like, oh no, that's what it's really about. But it's sort of about like, you know, feeling not connected to the people around you and all these sorts of things. And it never mentions Drew Barrymore at all. I think she said externally that like it like comes from, you know, like Drew Barrymore being like the kind of persona she had in her movies that says I'd watch growing up, like was like, you know, this kind of, you know, she was often like this kind of like awkward, you know, so she was like a, you know, kind of a, she was like a relatable figure in these films. Although I think like, you know, there's an interesting, you know, aspect to that where it's like clearly, you know, cause the world of the video is very much, you know, a world of, you know, young people of color, and you know, it's very coded in that way, and so this idea that like the gaze, you know, towards Drew Barrymore is like, oh, this is like the figure that I relate to, this is the, you know, like says a lot about, you know, pop culture and, you know, and how it's received. But then there's a moment in the video where she's like sitting on like these stairs, I don't know if it's in San Francisco or it's somewhere in Manhattan, that like has like, it's like, you know, a very steep street or a street with stairs coming up it. And, or maybe it's just the top of the subway or something, but she's like sitting there and she's looking really depressed. And Drew Barrymore walks up these stairs and like just walks by her and like kind of like gives her a little smile and nod and just like keeps walking. And that's her only presence in the whole thing. I just thought that's, it was incredible. It's such a great,
to go back to Ice Spice. So if you don't know Ice Spice, you should.
Keep. I know Sporty. I know Baby.
Not a Spice Girl. So she's part of the Brooklyn drill scene. Do you know about drill music?
I do know about drill music. Yeah. Which so comes from Chicago Ice, originally, but yeah,
it does. Shout out Chief Keef. So Ice Spice is just came out of nowhere. Talk about falling into things. You like how I got you with the through line, man. I got you guys. Ice Spice. So I discovered her. I discover is probably not the right word, because I read the New York Times like end of year best music list, and there's this song called Munch. And I was like, Munch? What? And it's a song about oral sex. And it's like, that guy's a munch. That guy is like, he's a simp. He, you know, he'll do whatever I say. And then she just released a song with Nicki Minaj called Princess Diana. And it's the same thing. She does say it in the song, but it's just like, it's so like tangential to what the song is actually about. And it's really just, it's just the iconography of Princess Diana. And it's this Brooklyn drill rapper who is this incredible red wig she always wears, this red afro. And she's just like, I'm the hood's Princess Diana or something. And it's just like one line. And the rest of the song, I'm sure, is about oral sex and the chain she has. But it's just, she's the best. She is the best.
You know, a couple generations ago, people didn't really talk about oral sex, and yet they were already saying sex sells. And I feel like we've arrived at the time in history where everybody's confirmed that sex sells, and now we can also talk about oral sex. And oral sex, big surprise, sells. People like oral sex as much or more than they like other forms of sex. And I mean, not everybody, but it's sure. It's really, I believe when we were in our 20s, wasn't that when
oral sex was invented? Song,
no, when that song grab.
No,
grab
I think that was the Apes with the mushroom.
No, that doesn't talk about oral sex. Actually, I'm having trouble thinking about oral sex. Songs are popular songs for a very long time since.
What's the song you're thinking of?
No, but it doesn't talk about oral sex, I think. It's just the one where it's like, grab your titties, grab your dicks. But it doesn't get into any oral sex.
Notorious B.I.G.
Yeah, but it doesn't get into any oral sex, I was thinking.
Okay. Have you guys seen The Sopranos?
We have.
I have never watched The Sopranos. I mean, maybe I've seen one or two episodes, but I have not. I have not done the full series. But
well, first of all, do that. Second of all, watch The Wire. But to go back to The Sopranos, there's this great arc of Corrado, Uncle Junior.
Yes, and the oral sex.
But I don't really care. Yes. And it's such a, so he's great at giving oral sex, but it's a secret because they think, he thinks the moth, like the rest of the family, if they found out, they'd kill him. But Carmela finds out because from all her like girlfriends, they hear about town that he's this incredible munch.
He's an incredible munch. And apparently generationally for Italian Americans of that generation in that time, it would be equivalent to being labeled. Yeah, he was basically saying that a man who goes down on his woman is equal to a gay man in the eyes of the mafia, and that a gay man is essentially a dead man.
Honestly,
in that culture,
my favorite
at that
part
time.
Of The Sopranos is Vito. They find he's gay, and they find
he's
out
terrified. The guys are terrified. It's
he
really
goes on the lam. He goes on the lam. Goes lives in New Hampshire, I think.
Yeah,
he falls in love with this volunteer firefighter, and it's just this beautiful, like, it was before press, I mean it created Prestige TV, but it was like the first ever like departure episode where you know, it's kind of tangential to the main plot. I mean, it becomes part of the main plot, but he has just this he goes to the diner where the guy works and he makes him like Johnny cakes, and it's beautiful. I love that show.
It's very powerful. It's excellent writing and acting nonstop.
Were you in that?
Did you know? Sorry.
Were you? Did you have a cameo in that or no?
No, but I'm acquainted with one of the executive producers and friends with someone who helped him write the.
Who's that? Who's that?
Matt Weiner, who later made Mad Men.
You know Matt Weiner.
I like how you're like. He's best known for working on The Sopranos.
I mean, in some ways. Well, wait, how do you know Matt Weiner? Chicago Academy of the Arts.
No, I lived in LA 4 times, and one of those times I was working with a guy. I'm going to visit this friend in Rome next week. He's shooting right now for Netflix, a show by the makers of Orange is the New Black. They've got a new show coming out, an adaptation of the Decameron. Yeah, they're doing the Decameron on Netflix with that team. It's going to be quite crazy. And he's one of the executive producers of that show.
I've ever heard one.
And that friend, Mike Uppendahl, before he had his own TV career as an independent director, he was assisting Matt Weiner in developing scripts and jokes and storylines and ideas. And so Matt, I was living with Mike that summer working on a theater show that Mike was directing while Mike was working on Becker, I think, and working with Matt on the side. And basically I would wake up on the couch every morning, maybe 3 or 4 times a week, and Matt would be there with Mike, and they'd wake me up usually and pass me a bong and say, "Hey, stoner, wake up, smoke this. And then tell us if this joke is funny." And, you know, normally I would, you know, just respond to the jokes and try to deal with the morning. And sometimes he would take us out to lunch, and it was nice. He's funny. I mean, he's nice, as I recall.
Are you still in touch?
No, I remember being in touch till like second or third season of Mad Men. And then...
So do you get a consultant? Are you stoner consultant or no?
Yeah, if you stay till the end of the credits each Mad Men episode, there is after the thing about animals not being harmed, it says there was one stoner forced to smoke.
No,
I love the Hennings have impeccable dry humor.
Yeah,
we got long eyelashes and we got impeccable dry humor.
That's right.
Well done.
You got. I believe this eyelash thing. I believe you mentioned that when Joel was our guest too. I think this eyelash thing. I also have very luscious eyelashes. Might be a Jewish thing.
A Jew thing, perhaps. Yeah.
I don't think. I think there's a lot of cultures. You know, there's about 15 million Jews in the world, and I think there's a lot of people that would say long eyelashes are not a Jew thing.
No, obviously not exclusively, but I am not. I am not related to you by blood, despite having just been called cousin Ira.
That we know
yes,
of.
We are related by blood. Right,
perhaps, yes. Oh, distantly
here, by blood. Can I do a funny story? Can I do a funny story?
No funny stories. Yes, of course.
All right, so my first kiss, I won't say her name. Perfect, you know, Jewish. This was a dream girl. My first love at my summer camp. We kissed behind the lacrosse shack. And so years pass, you know, on and off, you know, it's summer camp, summer love. And so we have this Mormon relative on my dad's side. Interesting. Also like a Ashkenazi Jew family. But this Mormon reaches out to my dad and my grandpa. And she's like, you know how the Mormons, they have in their huge church, they have all these records. I could do a whole podcast on my fascination with Mormons, but they have this huge vault of records. And so they also like, they tried to baptize Anne Frank and Adolf Hitler. They tried to claim everyone, but
I think they just went ahead and baptized them.
Yeah. That's the name of my first album, actually, Mormon Holocaust Baptism. but so anyway, they have this vault of records. They know who came over to Ellis Island when, and they're big into like lineage and ancestry. So, and they do this thing where they
.com.
Yeah, .com. And they do you think they'll pay us now?
Jiggle Little Open is brought to you by ancestry.com.
Because we're really into that.
And so
where I guess do those eyelashes come from?
You reach a certain point in your Mormon life where you're like, it's time, I'm going to do the family tree. So she made volumes and volumes, these leather bound, these beautiful 1,000-page family histories. And we're in volume one or two.
I think you do this because you have to know who is going to be on your planet with you after you die, right? Like there's like a very practical, you know, post life reason to have these family trees, because you have to gather.
Right. I really got to read
your clan on your private planet.
I saw you get the after Book you of die. Mormon. I saw the Book of Mormon, but that's all the research I've done for now.
I'm sorry, continue with your story.
I know a lot of the Bible because of Jesus Christ Superstar. I think we're officially insufficient.
No, I think that's all.
I know it from The Last Temptation of Christ.
There you go.
I'm a little more absolute.
Shout out Mel Gibson. Is that the Mel Gibson
one? It is definitely not. No.
Okay.
It is the opposite of that one. It's a novel by Nicholas Kazantzakis and then a film that Martin Scorsese made in the 80s.
Oh, that sounds good.
Right, but it's Willem Dafoe playing Jesus there.
Right.
No, it's not.
It is.
With the New York accent, but we continue to cut you off, and now I'm doing my Willem Dafoe and cutting you off. It's terrible. Please continue.
I gotta watch that. Willem Dafoe as Jesus.
Willem Dafoe as Jesus.
That's like a dream I had last night. but, okay, so she comes to our house, and we get the leather-bound volume, because we're gonna be on the planet with her, maybe, if we do right by Joseph. Who's the guy?
Biden.
Well, Joseph Smith, but I think you're trying to impress. Joseph Smith. I mean, God, I guess, but I don't know. The angel Moroni or whoever.
The lizard in the sky. And so we get this
I think
volume.
That's Scientology.
And so we find out we're living in Tulsa, Oklahoma now. And so
that's the name of the planet?
And so it goes back to Mamie Kaiman, Kate Keishman or something, who however many generations, and our rabbi's name in Tulsa is Dan Kamen. Of course, he's in the book. Pretty astounding. Whoa. And then so I'm flipping through, there's all these people at camp who I know, and I'm like, oh, that's really cool. And then there's we can take that out. There's this guy who I know from camp. And I'm like, wait a minute, that's this girl's first cousin. So I call her and I'm like, guess what? We're cousins. So my first kiss was with a distant cousin.
Ooh, kissing cousins, kissing cousins.
Kissing cousins.
Wow.
There you go.
I remember your aunt and mother surrounding Jason and I and kissing us and saying, kissing cousins, kissing cousins, kissing cousins. But we were probably like all under 10 years old, or at least I was. And this story of being related to all these people, I have to tell you something very surprising and strange. Dan Kamen, the name of your rabbi?
Oh, okay.
Is also the name of one of the world's foremost Charlie Chaplin experts and the man who trained Johnny Depp to, Robert Downey Jr. to play in Chaplin and trained Johnny Depp for other roles that involve Chaplin-like movement.
Do you think
and
he I know, did the Robert Downey Jr. one?
No, he did. I know he did. That was a job. He trained Robert Downey Jr. And I lived with his daughter as a roommate when we worked at Touchstone Theater in Pennsylvania. And his name is Dan Kamen. And as far as I remember, they're neither Jewish nor in Oklahoma nor a rabbi, but so much Chaplin. When my stepsister Marcia and her family come through Paris, we're going to see Charlie Chaplin's grandson, James Thierry, perform his new show called Room. But I love James Thierry's work. So there you go. I've taken it from the Mormons to the rabbi to Charlie Chaplin.
It's also the name of my my new children's book about a lovable reptilian creature in a Florida swamp, Dan the Cayman.
I don't get it.
I thought it was going to be the Mormon, the rabbi, and Charlie Chaplin.
a Cayman is a kind of, is like part of the species of, I forget if it's an alligator or a crocodile, but it's like very similar to...
Aaron, I just want you to know with all these interesting stories, you're earning a chapter of the novel.
Whoa. Oh my goodness.
Congratulations.
I'm very curious about the novel.
Can I just stay on the Mormons for a second? I don't know if your Mormon relative is in Utah, but it did remind me of I did a show with somebody who later became or through the process of doing the show became one of my really good friends and collaborators. The show in a broader sense was about different versions of utopia. And, he did a kind of, not autobiographical, but like, I guess, family history, piece about, his great grandmother, I think grandmother, or great grandmother who was born in Utah, in like the early 20th century, in a community of Jews who had come to the US, and then there was this kind of moment of like, Jewish self-sufficiency where like, a bunch of people like moved west and were like, we're gonna farm the land and become, basically, as self-sufficient as possible so that we're never subject to, the kind of oppression we've escaped in Europe or whatever. And actually I think they were kind of hoodwinked by Mormons. I think they were like sold farmland that was not farmable. And it was really, rough going, but it was, but like for a few decades, there were these kind of pockets of like, kind of Jewish separatist back to the land communities in the Utah desert, trying to kind of establish not a like Jewish homeland, because I don't think they were trying to it wasn't, they weren't creating a like, it wasn't a nationalist project necessarily, but like trying to like pull away from the Goyish society and start something on their own. So I don't know if there's a connection there, but maybe. I'm sure a few of them fell off the truck and stayed and became
and
Mormons.
Fell into something else.
Yeah, fell into Mormonism.
Fell into the Great Salt Lake and perhaps an enormous choir.
So I know we should wrap up, Jesse, I'm curious what's next for you. I'm sorry, Aaron, you have a question.
Yeah, I was about to say something similar. You brought up so many, especially in the first 10 or 12 minutes, you brought up whole corridors of self-revelation that we sort of just like hop onto the next moving scooter. So, what's next?
Sorry, I just need to write down corridors of self-revelation. And
then you know this is a recording and it'll be publicly available.
If you think I'm going to listen to this again, actually, I'll probably transcribe it for the novel. But,
sample it for your song.
There you go. So I'm writing this book. I have a long notes app
about it, and I'm actively writing more songs. Can I give your listeners a snippet of my next song?
Please. I was trying to figure if there's some way that we can put it in now by screen sharing or something, and it would be a big experiment that could be a big waste of time. So I could edit something in. You could stick it in now, and I can stick in a higher fidelity version of it later.
But I think he wants to just share it.
You know, play it. Do it raw. Do it.
No, no. So I can't play it because it's not yet been recorded.
Are you just going to rap with your voice right now?
Yeah, I'm just going to rap with my voice. So Otis is one of my favorite songs of all time. It's a Kanye song. For years, Kanye was my favorite artist. And then did you see the Jonah Hill thing?
I don't think so.
I mean, I've seen some Jonah Hill things. Kanye,
okay, so Kanye, you know, rampant anti-Semite at this point. But then he posts on Instagram, he was like, and it's a picture of 21 Jump Street, the Jonah Hill 21 Jump Street remake. And he's like, thank you, Jonah Hill. Now I understand I don't hate Jews. You can't hate a whole group of people. Jonah Hill made me understand that anti-Semitism is bad. To me, maybe the funniest thing of all time. Okay, so my vision for this song, I'm going to take the instrumental from this song Kanye did with Jay-Z called Otis, and it's an Otis Redding sample. It's one of the best beats of all time. Like, Kanye, say what you will about Kanye, but he knows how to chop up a sample. So the first line is Jay-Z saying, I invented swagger. So my first line is, I'm ripping their swagger. Like, I'm stealing their beat. Because, you know, I'm a Jew. I can do what I want with Kanye's stuff at this point. All right. So this is... we'll see how much I do. Okay. Jeff Goldblum is my idol. Defenestrate my rivals. Watch me as I'm playing 40 checkers with my eyes closed. Frankly, I'm cracked. That's can't guard my slat. I'm running the game. Stay out of my lane. I fucking AP, but Ye's insane. I love you, Jonah Hill. Don't want all these Jews killed. 21 Jump Street is a masterpiece. My name's not Jeff, but I'd be Channing's piece. It's frustrating that I'm funny like a Trump nickname. Meatball Ron couldn't say that I'm gay. Presidential aspirants, I'll need to take some aspirin. Take books from the band bin, indoctrinate some children. Florida man's an op, got guns because he's afraid. So fuck Rick Scott and the NRA. So I'll fly to Tallahassee just to scare those assholes. Copping iTunes gift cards, racking up my barcodes. Miami to St. Louis, St. Louis to Chicago. Crossing state lines with all the drugs that I know. We driving Benzes with some benefits. My dad paid for these purple tints. Build your churches. We dig in tunnels. Can't you see we control the banks from under you? Can't you see all these nuns flying over you? Sally Field is Norma Rae, Mary Todd, Lincoln 2, Jay is chilling. My brain keeps spinning. What more can I say? I'm killing you. Hold up before I end this campaign. As you can see, I forgot your damn name. Wait, I think I remember. Is it Jane? Sorry, your account's drained from my chains. And then I have a little spoken word part after where I'm like, for the record, I'm not actually sorry. My neck is literally an igloo at this point. There's an Inuit family living in it. Ha ha ha. That's what I'm working on.
Wow.
Thank you.
Wow.
I feel like we can't go any farther. I feel like that's...
No, there's really...
That's, we'll, you know, only, what they call, we'll, that in the business? They call it
a mic drop. Yeah, yeah, we need to stop as quickly as we can this episode in order to not pollute
Scholars of Jiggle a little Open will be analyzing that for generations. Exactly. Yeah. Yeah.
For generations.
Thank you.
Well, thank you for falling into our podcast, Jesse. I thought you were
gonna be like, sorry, you haven't written a novel yet. No. But thanks for having me.
I haven't written a novel yet either.
No, zero of our guests.
When the novel's out, I'll promote it. It'll be great.
You wouldn't only be our first guest who's written a novel if you come back once you've written the novel. You will also have been our only return guest.
It's true.
Save it. Don't let Joel Henning back on this.
Just write a novel, dude. Just write a novel and it's yours.
I'm trying, man. I'm really trying.
I know.
I believe in you.
I know your grandpa wrote a book, but not a novel. So
exactly.
Right. He's wrote many books, but the running one is really good. Studs Terkel interviewed him.
I know. I've listened to that. I was very impressed.
It's incredible.
Anybody who was interviewed by Studs Terkel is
a stud.
That's a stud, right? Yeah. Yeah. All right.
Thank you so much.
Thanks.
Of course. Thank you guys. This was great.
Yeah. yeah, this is amazing.
I should add that it's the longest conversation I've ever had with my first cousin once removed.
Indeed.
Jesse Schumann. And now it's a public, it's a public document as well. And it opens so many future conversations I'm so excited about.
Yeah. Wonderful. Well,
all right.
You know, if I can leave the listeners with one message.
Please.
Please.
Jiggle it a little open. That's all. That's all I got to say.
Bam. That's all we're saying with this podcast.
Until next time, it is 6:34 in the evening in Paris.
11:34 in the morning in Chicago. And it's jiggle time it. To say goodbye.
Thanks.